its surface and preventing the fat from getting too close. Because the fat can't come in contact with the food, heat transfer is inefficient with fresh oil. This means longer cooking times, less crispness, and less fried flavor. Remember, fried flavor comes from a combination of browning, dehydration, and fat absorption. Slightly older oil, on the other hand, has got a few surfactants in the mix. These molecules that allow fat and water to come close to each other. Because of that, older oil is better able to penetrate foods, cooking them far faster and giving you crisper, better, flavored crusts. As any longtime fry cook will tell you, you should always save a bit of the old fry oil to add to the new batch if you want to make sure your foods come out at optimum crispness right from the first batch of fresh oil. For home cooks, this amount can be as little as a tablespoon of old oil per quart of new oil. What should I do with the oil in between batches of frying? Just as with fresh oil, used oil should be stored in a cool, dark, relatively airtight environment. If you are planning to do a bunch of frying over the course of a few days, this can be as easy as straining it through a fine mesh strainer lined with cheesecloth or a paper towel into a pot with a metal lid, not glass, glass lets in light, and keeping it in a cool corner of the kitchen. For longer-term storage, strain the used oil through a fine mesh strainer, then funnel it back into its original packaging. Seal tightly and store it in a cool, dark cabinet. And what should I do once the oil finally does reach the point where it can't be reused anymore? How do I get rid of it? Discarding used oil can be a real pain in the butt. Small amounts, say less than a half cup or so, can be poured down the drain with plenty of soap and warm water. The soap helps the oil emulsify with the water, preventing it from sticking to and coating the insides of your pipes. But larger amounts require a bit more care. The absolute best way to get rid of used oil is to donate it to an organization that collects spent oil to be used as fuel for specially adapted cars. In Boston, we used to call them McNugget Mobiles because the exhaust smells like a fast food kitchen. Unfortunately, these aren't that easy to come by. The easiest way for the home cook to discard used oil is to save its original container, funnel the cooled used oil back into it, screw on the cap, and dispose of it with the solid garbage. Keys to maximizing oil use. Here's a quick and dirty guide to maximizing the lifespan of your oil. Watch the temperature. Don't let oil get past its smoke point, where rapid breakdown will occur. Remove excess batter and breading meticulously during and after frying. Small particles of batter, breadcrumbs, and especially flour can collect in the bottom of your cooking vessel, causing the oil to break down. Carefully remove debris after frying. Use a fine mesh strainer to fish out any debris from your oil while it is still hot. For maximum effectiveness, strain the oil through a fine mesh strainer lined with cheesecloth or a paper towel between each use to completely clean it. Store the oil in a cool, dark, dry place. For short-term storage, up to a few days, a pot with a metal lid in a cool corner of the kitchen is fine. For long-term storage, return it to its original container, seal tightly, and store it in a cool, dark cabinet. The smoke points of common oils. Every oil has a smoke point, the temperature at which wisps of smoke will appear on its surface, and a flash point, the temperature at which actual flames will start dancing across the top. Oils used for deep frying should never be heated to either of these temperatures, for both safety and flavor reasons. In the bonus PDF, there is a chart of the smoke points of most common oils, along with a percentage of saturated fat they contain. There are many reasons to pick various oils for frying jobs. Some folks choose oils with lower saturated fat contents, like olive, canola, or rapeseed oil, for health reasons. But who are we kidding? We don't eat fried foods for their health benefits. Others pick oils high in saturated fats with relatively high smoke points for their superior frying ability. It's up to you, but I know which way I lean. My oil of choice for deep frying is almost always peanut oil, which has a high smoke point and enough saturated fat to give a perfectly crisp crust without it tasting waxy or heavy, as shortening, lard, or other animal fats can. The use of the term vegetable oil is not strictly regulated. It can contain any combination of certain oils. Practically, however, it's almost always a combination of corn, canola, and/or sunflower oil, and its smoke point will fall somewhere in the 400 degree to 450 degree Fahrenheit range. The myth of the fry. Using hotter oil does not lead to less oil in your food. Crack open nearly any book about deep frying, and you'll find this advice. Make sure that your oil is hot enough before adding your food, or it will absorb fat and become greasy. The theory is that as long as your oil is hot enough, as soon as you lower your food into it, the outward pressure of water vapor bubbles escaping the food will prevent oil from rushing into the food, and therefore your food will remain grease-free. At first glance, it makes sense, right? I mean, we've all eaten bad fried food that's come out of a too-cool fryer, and indeed it does taste heavy and greasy. But is it actually because it contains more grease? A study reported in the Journal of Food Process Engineering says differently. Turns out that the truth is quite the opposite. The hotter you fry your food, the more oil it will absorb. See, most foods that you throw in the fryer, whether batter-coated food, potatoes, or a hunk of chicken, are filled with water. They are literally saturated with the stuff. Imagine that French fry, for example, as a hotel with no vacancies. Every single room is filled up with a water molecule. In order for any oil at all to penetrate the potato and take up residence, some of that water must first check out. If you think about this, you already know it. Drop a piece of cold potato into a cold pot of oil. Does it absorb any of that oil? Nope. Wash the potato off, and it's as if the oil was never there. Now, here's the thing. Water is pretty happy with its cellular accommodations. The only way to get it to leave is through forceful eviction, namely by adding some energy to it in the form of heat. When you drop a piece of potato into hot oil, energy from the oil is transferred to the water inside it, which will eventually absorb so much energy that it leaps from within the potato's cells and escapes in a bubble of vapor, thus freeing up a room for the oil to check into. The water in a piece of food being fried exists in two forms. Free water will easily escape, jumping out of the food at relatively low temperature. Bound water, on the other hand, requires significantly more energy and a higher temperature before it escapes. Heat a potato slice up to 275 degrees Fahrenheit, and despite the fact that the temperature is well above the boiling point of water, some of the bound water will remain inside until you get it even hotter. So, the hotter you fry a food, the more water will escape, and the more room is left for oil to be absorbed. This was all pretty shocking news to me, so I did what any good skeptic would do. I tested it. I filled my wok with 2 quarts of oil and weighed it on a precise scale. Next, I heated the oil to 275 degrees Fahrenheit and maintained that temp while I fried chicken for a fixed period of time. After removing the chicken, I weighed the oil remaining in the wok. I then repeated the test, this time maintaining the oil at 325 degrees Fahrenheit while cooking the chicken. After repeating the test a few times, the results confirmed what I had read. The hotter the temperature, the more oil the chicken absorbed. There's an explanation commonly given for why foods cooked at a higher temperature supposedly absorb less fat. The outward pressure of water vapor rapidly escaping from the food prevents the influx of oil. This may be true while the food is actually in the hot oil, but as soon as it's removed, its temperature drops rapidly. What once was positive pressure being exerted from inside the food reverses itself and results in a partial vacuum within a matter of milliseconds. Rather than pushing water vapor out, the food rapidly sucks the oil clinging to its surface into its interior. Even the fastest fry cook in the world can't drain his onion rings fast enough to stop this influx of oil. Up to 70% of the oil absorbed by fried foods is absorbed within the first few seconds after it comes out of the fryer. But despite having absorbed less oil, the chicken cooked at 275 degrees Fahrenheit which was limp and oily, tasted much greasier than the crisp chicken cooked at 325 degrees Fahrenheit. It turns out that what we describe as greasy actually has nothing to do with the total amount of grease in a food. It's just an illusion. Rather, it's the combination of surface oil and a mushy, moist breading or batter in our mouths that gives us the sensation of greasiness or heaviness. Crisp, well-fried batter, breading, or chicken skin may contain more fat, but it sure doesn't taste that way. Lesson learned. When frying, cooking at a higher temperature is absolutely essential if you want your food to be crisp and to not taste greasy. But don't fool yourself into thinking there's less fat in it. Batters and breadings. Have you ever dropped a naked, skinless chicken breast into the deep fryer? I strongly advise against it. The moment it enters a vat full of 400 degree Fahrenheit oil, a couple of things start happening. First, the water content will rapidly convert to steam, bubbling out like a geyser, and the chicken's outer tissues become drier and drier. At the same time, the soft network of folded proteins in its musculature will begin to denature and tighten, firming its flesh and squeezing out juices. Pull it out a minute or two later, and you'll discover that it's become quite stiff, with a layer of desiccated meat a good 1/4 inch thick surrounding it. This is when you'll quite rightfully say to yourself, "Ah, I wish I had battered that first." Batters are made by combining some sort of flour, usually wheat flour, though cornstarch and rice flour are not uncommon, with a liquid and optional leavening or binding ingredients like eggs and baking powder. They coat foods in a thick, goopy layer. Breadings consist of multiple layers. Generally, a single layer of flour is applied directly to the food to ensure that its surface is dry and rough so that the second layer, the liquid binder, will adhere properly. That layer generally consists of beaten eggs or a dairy product of some kind. The last layer gives the food texture. It can consist of a plain ground grain, like the flour or cornmeal in a traditional fried chicken breading, ground nuts, or any number of dry ground bread or bread-like products, such as breadcrumbs, crackers, or breakfast cereals. No matter how your breading or batter is constructed, it serves the same function. Adding a layer of stuff around the item being fried means the oil has a tough time coming in direct contact with it, and thus has a hard time transferring energy to it. All the energy being transferred to the food has to go through the medium of a thick, air pocket-filled coating. Just as the air-filled insulation in your house helps mitigate the effects of harsh external conditions on the air temperature inside, so do batters and breadings help the food underneath cook more gently and evenly, rather than burning or becoming desiccated by the fiercely energetic oil. Of course, while the food inside is gently cooking, the precise opposite is happening to the batter or breading. It's drying out, and its structure is getting firmer and firmer. Frying is essentially a drying process. Batters and breadings are formulated to dry out in a particularly graceful way. Rather than burning or turning leathery, a nice airy batter forms a delicately crisp, air-filled web of teeny tiny bubbles, a solid foam that provides substance and crunch. Breadings work similarly, though rather than foamy in structure, they're craggy. The nooks and crannies in a good breadcrumb coating vastly increase the surface area of the food being fried, giving you more crunch in each bite. In the ideal world, a batter or breading becomes perfectly crisp, just as the food inside, say a slice of onion or a delicate piece of fish, approaches the ideal level of doneness. Achieving this balance is the mark of a good fry cook. The recipes in this chapter will cover all of the basic types of breadings and batters, as well as some other forms of breading and batter-free frying. Coating Style 1. Flour Dredging. Southern-style fried chicken. I know how passionate people can get about fried chicken, and I'm not one to tell you who makes the best. But if you were to ask Ed Levine, the Serious Eats overlord, he'd tell you that it's Gus's, a 67-year-old institution in Mason, Tennessee. They serve fried chicken that he describes as incredibly crunchy, with a crisp, craggy crust, juicy meat, and a cosmic oneness between the breading and the skin. We're talking fried chicken so good that you have to resort to metaphysics to make sense of it. For me, as a kid growing up in New York, fried chicken came from one place and one place only: those grease-stained cardboard buckets peddled by the Colonel himself. To my young mind, KFC's Extra Crispy was about as good as it got. I distinctly remember eating it, picking the coating off in big, fat chunks, tasting the spicy, salty grease, and shredding the meat underneath with my fingers and delivering it to my waiting mouth. It was heavenly. But times have changed, and as is often the case, revisiting those fond childhood memories results only in disappointment and disillusionment. All over the country, there's a fried chicken and soul food renaissance going on. Even the fanciest restaurants in New York are adding it to their menus. My eyes and my taste buds have been opened to what fried chicken truly can be. I may still dig the ultra-crunchy, well-spiced crust that KFC puts on its birds, but that's about the only thing it has going for it: flaccid skin, dry and stringy breast meat, and chicken that tastes like, well, it's hard to tell if it really tastes like anything once you get rid of the crust. That said, stylistically, it can't be faulted. So I figured that I could somehow manage to take what the Colonel started and bring it to its ultimate conclusion. That is, deep chicken flavor, a flab-free skin, juicy, tender meat, and crisp, spicy coating. I might just be able to recapture those first fleeting childhood tastes of fried chicken as I remembered them. Inside Out. I started with a working recipe of chicken pieces simply dipped in buttermilk and tossed in flour, seasoned with salt and black pepper, then fried in peanut oil at 325 degrees Fahrenheit until cooked through. A few problems immediately became clear. First off, timing. By the time my chicken was cooked through, that's 150 degrees Fahrenheit in the breasts and 165 degrees Fahrenheit in the legs, the outer crust was a dark brown, bordering on black in spots. Not only that, but it didn't have nearly as much crunch as I wanted. Finally, the meat underneath the crust wasn't completely desiccated, but I wouldn't exactly describe it as moist, not to mention its rather bland flavor. I decided to fix my chicken from the inside out. The problem is that with fried chicken, the crisp, well-seasoned coating is merely a surface treatment. None of that flavor penetrates very deeply. Surely brining and/or marinating should help with that problem. Brining is the process by which a lean meat, most often chicken, turkey, or pork, is submerged in a saltwater solution. As the meat sits, the salt water will slowly dissolve key muscle proteins, most notably myosin, a protein that acts as a sort of glue holding muscle fibers together. As the myosin dissolves, three things take place. First, the ability of the meat to hold on to moisture increases. You can imagine meat as a series of long, skinny toothpaste tubes tied together. As you cook the meat, the tubes of toothpaste get squeezed, pushing out valuable juices. Breading will help mitigate this effect to a degree by slowing down the transfer of energy to the meat, but a significant amount of squeezing is still going to occur, regardless of how well breaded the chicken is. Myosin is one of the key proteins responsible for this squeezing action, so by dissolving it, you prevent a lot of moisture loss from taking place. Second, brining alters the texture of the meat by allowing dissolved proteins to cross-link with each other. This is the main principle behind sausage making. Dissolved proteins can bond with each other, creating a pleasantly bouncy, tender texture. By brining a chicken breast or a pork chop, you're in effect giving it a very light cure, the same process that converts a raw ham into a supple prosciutto. Third, as the brine slowly works its way into the meat, it seasons it beyond just the very surface. An overnight brine will penetrate a few millimeters into the meat, giving you built-in seasoning before you ever get to the breading. Brines also improve juiciness by increasing the muscle's ability to retain moisture. My normal brining for chicken breast is anywhere from 30 minutes to 2 hours. In this case, however, a much, much longer brining time was necessary in order to completely mitigate the effects of high-temperature frying, delivering a uniquely smooth, juicy texture to the meat. A full 6 hours submerged in salt sugar water produced a beauty. Weighing the meat confirmed that an overnight brined, then fried bird loses about 9% less moisture than an unbrined bird does and is significantly tastier. I've experimented with tossing certain animal preparations with a mixture of baking powder and salt a day in advance in order to improve their crispness. The salt acts as a brine, while the baking powder raises the pH of the skin, causing it to brown more efficiently, and the thin film of protein-rich liquid around it to form microbubbles that can add crispness. I tried this method on my fried chicken, but it ended up drying the skin out too much, making it tough to get the breading to remain attached down the line. Knowing that I'd be soaking my chicken in buttermilk the next day anyway, I wondered if I'd be able to kill two birds with one stone by replacing the water in the brine with buttermilk. Not only did the chicken come out just as moist with the water brine, it was actually significantly more tender as well, due to the tenderizing effects of buttermilk on food. Soaking it for more than one night led to chicken that was so tender that it bordered on mush. Finally, hitting the buttermilk with spices helped build flavor right into the surface of the bird. I played around a bit with the mix before arriving at a blend of cayenne pepper and paprika for their heat and peppery flavor, garlic powder, a bit of dried oregano, and a healthy slug of freshly ground black pepper. The Colonel may use 11 secret herbs and spices in his chicken recipe, but 5 was quite enough for me, and both my wife and my doorman heartily concurred. Crust lust. Next up, add some extra crunch to that crust. I reasoned that there were a few ways to do this. First off, I wanted to increase the crust's thickness. I tried double dipping my chicken, that is, dredging the brined chicken in flour, seasoned with the same spice blend as my brine, dipping it back into the buttermilk, and then dredging it once more in flour before frying, a method Chef Thomas Keller uses for his justifiably famous fried chicken at Ad Hoc. This worked marginally better. That second coat definitely developed more crags than the first coat did. But it also made for an extremely thick breading that had a tendency to fall off the breast because of its heft. Much better was to simply add a bit of extra structure to the breading in the form of an egg mixed into the buttermilk. My crust was certainly thick enough now, but I ran into another problem. Rather than crisp and crunchy, it was bordering on tough, almost rock-like in its density. Knowing that gluten, the network of proteins formed when flour meets water, was the most likely culprit, I sought out ways to minimize its formation. First and foremost, cut the protein-rich wheat flour with cornstarch, a pure starch that adds moisture-absorbing capabilities to the breading without adding excess protein. Replacing a quarter of the flour worked well. Adding a couple teaspoons of baking powder to the mix helped bring a bit of air to the mix, forming a crust that was lighter and crisper with increased surface area. And we all know that more surface area equals more crispness, right? Finally, I used a trick that a friend, a former employee of the Chick-fil-A Southern fast food fried chicken chain, had told me about. He'd mentioned that once the chicken was breaded, the later batches always come out better than the earlier ones, as bits of the flour mixture clumped together, making for an extra craggy coat. Adding a couple tablespoons of buttermilk to the breading mix and working it in with my fingertips before dredging the chicken simulated this effect nicely. The last problem, the coating overcooking long before the chicken is cooked through to the center, was simple to solve. Just fry the chicken until golden brown, then transfer it to a hot oven to finish cooking at a gentler pace. The result is chicken with a deep brown, craggy crust that's shatteringly crisp, but not tough, and that breaks away to meat that bursts with intensely seasoned juices underneath. Even crunchier fried chicken? I was chatting with my friend, the San Francisco chef Anthony Mint, a while back, when he mentioned that whenever he has leftover fried chicken, he'll fry it in hot oil again the second day, resulting in chicken that's even better than it was the first day. Normally, there's a limit to how much moisture you can drive out the coating on a piece of fried chicken, defined by how long you leave it in the oil. Let it get too hot, and the exterior will start to burn. But if you let it cool overnight, some of the moisture from the inner layers of coating will work their way toward the exterior. When you fry it again the second day, this moisture is driven off, leaving you with an extra thick layer of dehydrated coating around your chicken. Not only is it a great way to treat leftovers, but if you've got the time, allowing your regular fried chicken to rest at room temperature or in the refrigerator for an hour or two before refrying it will give you the same results, all in a single day's work. The rejects. I wasn't kidding when I said that I tested this recipe thoroughly. I went through more than 50 whole chickens and over 100 separate iterations and tests to get there, at times filling up all of my cooling racks with samples so that I was then forced to drain some of the chicken on a dish rack. I made every conceivable bad version of fried chicken along the way. Experiment. Is it a best to rest? Here's a question that has always vexed me. Many existing recipes for fried chicken advise you to let the chicken rest for a half hour or so after breading it before frying it. But very few offer an explanation as to why, which led me to question the very practice. Is fried chicken really better when you let it rest? I cooked a few batches of chicken side by side to find out. Materials. Refer to the recipe for extra crunchy southern fried chicken. Procedure. Follow the recipe as directed through step 3, but do not heat the oil yet. In step 4, dredge half the chicken pieces in a seasoned flour, place them on a rack set on a rimmed baking sheet, and let sit undisturbed for at least 30 minutes and up to 1 hour. Heat up the oil as directed in step 3. Dredge the remaining chicken pieces and immediately fry and finish baking all the chicken as directed, being careful to keep track of which batch is which. Taste both batches of chicken and note their texture, results, and analysis. While neither batch will be bad, the chicken that was allowed to rest before frying should end up significantly tougher with a hard, brittle crust instead of the crisp, crunchy crust of the chicken dropped into the fryer immediately after dredging. Why is this? Once again, it's our friend gluten. As the chicken rests, the flour in the dredging gradually absorbs moisture from the buttermilk and the surface of the chicken. As it absorbs moisture, its proteins begin to unfold and link up with each other, forming a sheath that grows tougher and tougher as it sits. Let it sit for too long, and you'll get a crust hard enough to crack your teeth. Fried chicken should be crisp, never tough, and to achieve this goal, you want to get your chicken from flour to oil as rapidly as possible. Of course, this introduces a problem. Freshly dredged chicken will release a ton of dry flour into the oil, which will cause the oil to go bad very fast. My advice is to shake the bejesus out of those chicken pieces in a metal strainer as they come out of the flour mix, so that there are as few excess particles of flour as possible. Pounding meat. The easiest way to pound meat into a thin, even layer without making a mess is to place it between two sheets of plastic wrap or inside a heavy-duty Ziploc bag with the sides split open with a knife. This will ensure that the steak doesn't stick to your cutting board or your pounding device, allowing it to thin easily and evenly. A meat pounder is nice to have if you've got the space, but a heavy 8-inch skillet will do the job perfectly adequately. Coating Style 2. Breadcrumb Coating. Fractals, panko, and breadcrumb coatings. Have you ever heard of Mandelbrot fractals? They're computer-generated images that appear on a small scale, very much as they do on a large scale. Fractals are something that occur in nature quite often. The outlines of a cloud, for instance, or the leaves on a fern. One well-known fractal effect pertains to coastlines. When you look at a coastline from far away and measure it, you'll measure a certain perimeter. As you zoom closer and closer, you realize there are tiny inlets or curves in the beach that weren't visible from far away. When measured again, these bumps add length to the total perimeter. This is a phenomenon known as the Richardson effect, which basically says that the more precisely you measure a coastline, the longer the measurement gets. And the more bumpy or irregular the surface is, the more pronounced the effect. Well, the same applies to breaded foods, though a non-breaded chicken cutlet and a breaded chicken cutlet have essentially the same mass and volume, because of the irregular edges of the breaded cutlet, it actually has far greater surface area than the nude chicken. Panko, Japanese-style breadcrumbs, can further enhance this effect. In contrast to sandy or coarse crumbs, panko crumbs are wide, craggly flakes that jut out wildly when applied, providing over twice as much surface area as regular breadcrumbs. Now that's adding some major crunch. How microwave ovens work. A microwave oven works by bombarding food with electromagnetic radiation in the microwave frequency spectrum. That may sound scary, but bear in mind that not all electromagnetic radiation is bad. Both heat and visible light, for instance, consist of electromagnetic radiation in a frequency spectrum that our eyes or heat-sensitive nerves are able to detect. Charged molecules, such as water molecules, will have a tendency to try to align themselves with the electric field created by a microwave. So as the long waves of a microwave pass by them, they will rapidly flip back and forth as they try to stay aligned. The resultant friction cooks your food. Microwaves can penetrate deeply into solid matter, up to several centimeters, though the denser and thicker the food, the less penetration a microwave will get. Dense, relatively dry items, like, say, your sister's My Little Pony dolls, can take a long time to heat up. Not that I'd know through personal experience. Porous, moist slices of eggplant, on the other hand, are microwave gold, cooking evenly and rapidly. Because microwave ovens allow so little energy to be lost to the outside environment, unlike the way, for example, a gas burner will heat up the room, they are extremely efficient at heating water. But there's one thing to be aware of. It's called superheating, and it is as cool as it sounds. Heat up water in a blemish-free container with minimal disturbance, and because of a lack of nucleation points, it's possible to heat it well beyond its boiling point without it ever boiling. As soon as some turbulence is introduced, though, a little wobble from the turntable, for example, bubbles burst forth, sending hot water all over the inside of your microwave. This doesn't happen on the stovetop, since heating from the bottom of the pot creates lots of convection currents, the movement that occurs between relatively hot and cool regions of liquid or gas. You can avoid this by sticking a wooden spoon into your cup of water in the microwave to provide nucleation sites. It's a lot like my lovely wife, who will quietly suppress tiny annoyances until suddenly the slightest disturbance sends her into an all-out rage. Unfortunately, the wooden spoon method does not work on her. Coating Style 3. Beer Batter. Beer battered fried fish. Here's the thing. Fish is extremely delicate, while frying is horribly violent. Dropping a hunk of fish into a pot of hot oil is like throwing an Ewok into a cage match with a Terminator. It doesn't stand a rat's chance in hell. This is particularly true of white-fleshed, slow-moving, bottom-dwelling fish like cod or halibut. These large ichthyoids spend a vast majority of their time slowly grazing along the ocean floor like gigantic cows of the sea. As such, their muscles don't get much of a workout. Just as with land animals, the less they use their muscles, the more delicate they'll be in both flavor and texture. It's this mildness that is prized above all in these white-fleshed fish, and it's a characteristic that we should attempt to maximize during cooking. Just like steak and chicken, fish flesh will dry out and toughen if cooked to too high a temperature. Our goal with a fish like cod is to bring it up to around 150 degrees to 160 degrees Fahrenheit, just hot enough to break down the thin, film-like membranes of connective tissue between the layers of muscle, but not hot enough to dry it out. This is why you want to batter fish before dropping it into the oil. Battering is all about mitigating the energy transfer from the hot oil in order to gently steam the food on the interior while simultaneously causing the proteins in the batter to coagulate and eventually dehydrate, forming a crisp crust. Even though the fish is completely submerged in a pot of 350 degree Fahrenheit oil, it cooks relatively gently and evenly from all sides because of its coat of batter. This gives you, the intrepid cook, quite a bit of leeway, making perfectly tender flesh not just a distinct possibility, but in fact quite easy. And for those of you who worry about the smell of fried fish, don't. It's not as bad as you think. What's in a batter? A batter consists primarily of two ingredients, flour and water. The loose proteins in the flour gradually link up with each other in the presence of water, creating gluten, which is what causes your batter to stick to the food being fried as well as to itself. Use too much flour or stir the batter too vigorously and you get too much gluten, which retains liquid and fat, weighing your batter down and turning it chewy or greasy. Similarly, the temperature of your ingredients can have a profound effect. Keep your liquids ice cold until you mix them into the flour, in order to minimize gluten development. It's the proportion and manner in which these ingredients are mixed, as well as what other ingredients are added, that determine how crisp and light your final fried product will be. Here are some common ingredient substitutions and additions. Using beer or soda water in place of water adds carbonation, which helps to leaven the batter. As the tiny bubbles of carbon dioxide are heated, they expand, creating a more open texture. Beer also adds flavor compounds and carbohydrates that aid in browning. Eggs add a concentrated source of protein, allowing you to create a firm structure using less flour, resulting in the characteristic thin, wispy, and crisp coating in traditional Japanese tempura. Baking powder and baking soda form carbon dioxide when dissolved and heated. For baking soda, you also need another acid source. This puffs and lightens the batter. Other grains like rice flour or cornstarch or corn flour can have varying effects. Rice flour and cornstarch can be used to dilute the protein concentration of pure wheat flour, giving the batter a lighter structure. You still need at least a bit of protein or it won't have any structure at all. Corn flour has larger grains than wheat flour, which add the crunch you get in a hush puppy or good corn dog. The first order of business with any batter is to get the consistency right. Too thick and it comes out bready. Too thin and it doesn't offer enough protection. It's also essential to balance leavening power and gluten development. Too little leavening and you get a hard, tough shell. Too much, and your batter will overinflate and strip itself off your food. Rather than using straight-up flour for my batter, I use a combo of flour and cornstarch, which reduces the amount of gluten formed, the protein network that can cause a batter to become leathery and tough. Gluten formation is also increased with excessive stirring, so mixing the batter with a whisk or a pair of chopsticks just until it barely comes together is the way to go. A few spots of raw flour are perfectly fine. There are a couple reasons to use beer. First off, sugars present in the beer will increase the brownability of the batter. The bubbles are also essential. They create the tiny, tiny pockets inside a good batter that add to our perception of crunchiness. It's really just a little boost for the baking powder, which performs a similar function. There's another element in there that's helping to keep my batter nice and light and crisp, the alcohol. Regulars of the now-closed Lenox Liquors on Lenox at 133rd will recognize Georgi as the cheapest vodka they offer, while fans of Heston Blumenthal will recognize vodka as one of the ingredients in his perfect fish and chips recipe. If you are in the small group of people who recognize both this bottle and its context, then we are kindred spirits, and I welcome you to my home for fried fish any day of the year. When Heston presented the idea, initially the thought was that the volatility of the vodka, that is, its propensity to evaporate quickly, would cause it to jump out of the batter faster as it fried, allowing the batter to dehydrate more quickly and thus brown faster and also crisp up better. At that task, it serves admirably. If you add alcohol to your batter, it dries out faster than if you just use water. Indeed, increasing the alcohol content by, say, adding a shot or two of 80-proof vodka in place of some of the beer can accelerate this process significantly, resulting in a lighter, crisper coating. There's an even more important factor it brings to the table: limiting gluten development. Gluten will develop in the presence of water, but not alcohol. Replacing part of the liquid in a batter with alcohol will allow you to achieve a batter with the exact same texture when raw, but with significantly less gluten development, leading to crisper structure when fried. I experimented using a few different coating methods: flouring before battering, battering the fish straight up, etc. I found that the most effective method, the one that resulted in the best balance between crispness and lightness, was to give the fish a quick coat in the flour mixture, followed by a dip in the batter, and then a second dip into the flour before lowering it into the fryer. I admit, the method is not the neatest. You're going to end up breading your hands, and once the fish has come out of the drippy batter and back into the flour, it's important to work fast before the coating all starts to drip off. I find the easiest method is to drop the battered fish into the flour, throw some more flour on top to coat, and then pick it up by scooping under it and tossing it back and forth between your hands to get rid of excess flour. From there, it goes straight into a wok, or Dutch oven, full of hot oil. Finally, it's important to make sure your beer is ice cold, for three reasons. 1. Cold liquids hold their carbonation better. 2. Cold liquids inhibit the formation of gluten. 3. The recipe only calls for 1 cup of beer, so you're gonna have to drink the leftovers. Can oil boil? We've all heard the phrase, boiled in oil, and we've certainly seen a pot of oil bubbling vigorously when you add food to it. But can oil truly boil? Technically, yes. Practically, no. Boiling, as we discussed earlier, is the conversion of a liquid to a gas. Depending on how tightly their molecules are stuck together, various liquids boil at various temperatures. Water boils at 212 degrees Fahrenheit, while extremely volatile liquid nitrogen boils at negative 320 degrees Fahrenheit. The boiling point of oil is far greater. In reality, oil begins to smoke and will eventually catch on fire long before it can possibly reach its boiling temperature. The smoke point, the temperature at which wisps of smoke begin to appear above the oil, and the flash point, the temperature at which the oil actually catches on fire, can vary from oil to oil, but are generally in the 375 degree to 550 degree Fahrenheit range, well below the actual boiling temperature of oil. What you are seeing in a pot of boiling oil is not the oil boiling. You're seeing the water content of the food you are frying in it boiling and bubbling its way up through the oil, giving you the illusion that the oil is bubbling. As soon as you take the food, and therefore the water, out, the boiling will stop. Onion rings. At their physical core, onion rings couldn't be more different from fried fish. But at their philosophical core, they are one and the same. In each case, the goal is to prevent the browning and toughening of the main ingredient being fried, that would be the onions or the cod, while simultaneously adding textural contrast and flavor to the exterior. It's always difficult to decide whether to get onion rings or fries. Get a combo if they'll let you. Proper beer-battered onion rings, with a substantial crisp crust covering a sweet, tender, thick ring of onion, are one of life's three greatest pleasures, and the only one that can be enjoyed legally, incidentally. But how often do you get perfect rings? These are the four most common ways that a good beer-battered onion ring turns into a bad one. Not enough batter. When there's too little batter, the onion is exposed to the full ravaging power of the oil. Its sugars rapidly caramelize and then burn, while tissues dry out, turning papery and tough. Too much batter. This is almost worse than having batter that's too thin. Instead of staying light and crisp, an onion ring with too much batter will retain too much internal moisture, and as soon as it comes out of the oil, the batter starts getting soggy. The split shell. This occurs when everything appears to be going fine, until all of a sudden, through some as yet undiscovered mechanism, the batter crust spontaneously splits in half. Oil rushes into the gap, rendering the onion leathery and burnt. The dreaded worm. This is the most heinous of onion ring crimes. It occurs when the onions aren't cooked thoroughly, so that rather than breaking off cleanly with each bite, you're left with a long worm of onion in your mouth and the hollow shell left behind in your hand. Dealing with the batter problems is a snap. We've already got an awesome recipe for light, crisp, lacy, just thick enough batter for our fried cod. But what about splitting and worming? Splitting was a tough case to crack. What could cause the batter shell to break open like that? To figure it out, I carefully dissected an afflicted ring with a set of tweezers and discovered that it's not the batter that's the problem, it's the onion. Every layer inside an onion is separated from the next by a thin, papery membrane. You can quite easily see it if you rub the inside of a raw onion ring. The membrane will slip off. Because of their thinness and lack of structure, these membranes shrink much more than the ring itself during cooking. And it's this shrinkage that tears a hole in the partially set batter, allowing oil to rush inside. Removing the membranes before battering solved the problem, but it was a tedious process, about as much fun as trying to brush my dog's teeth, and much less cute. Soaking the rings in water for half an hour before attempting the separation helped, but I found it was far better to place the onion rings in the freezer. When vegetables are frozen, their water content crystallizes into large, jagged shards of ice, puncturing cells, which results in limp vegetables. In most cases, this is a bad thing. That's why frozen vegetables are almost never as good as fresh. With onions destined for the batter, however, this is not a defect. Indeed, aside from making the inner membranes easier to remove, freezing tenderized the rings to the point that they could be broken quite easily when bitten. I'd inadvertently ended up solving my worming problem as well. I was so ecstatic at the breakthrough that the only logical course of action was to commemorate the discovery with a celebratory batch of perfectly crisp, perfectly tender, worm and crack-free, golden brown, beer-scented, sweet and salty onion rings. Experiment. Gluten development in batter. Just as in a kneaded bread dough, gluten, the network of interconnected flour proteins, can form in a heavily mixed batter. Need proof? Try this little test. Materials. Refer to the ingredients list for foolproof onion rings. Procedure. Follow the recipe through step 3. Divide the batter in half and whisk one half of it for an extra minute. Proceed with the recipe as directed, using regular batter and the overmixed batter, and making sure to keep the rings separate from each when you fry them. Results. Taste the rings side by side. You'll find that the rings with the regular batter are light and crisp, while the rings with the over-whisked batter are chewier, denser, and doughier. As you continue to whisk a batter, protein molecules in the flour, gliadin and glutenin, form tighter and tighter bonds with each other. Eventually, those bonds are so tight that even the leavening power of baking powder is not enough to lighten and leaven the batter. It stays dense. Interconnected proteins also turn the texture leathery instead of crisp and tender. Lesson learned. Do not overmix batter. Coating style 4. Thin batters. Japanese style tempura. Tempura-style batters were originally brought to Japan by Portuguese missionaries in the 16th century. Since then, tempura has been perfected to a near art form by Japanese chefs. At the best tempura houses in Japan, all of your courses will be cooked by a single tempura chef who spent years in apprenticeship before ever being allowed to touch the batter or fry oil. Tempura chefs are sort of like the Jedi of the cooking world. They must deftly perform with the utmost skill and precision, using extremely dangerous tools, all while maintaining a calm, serene demeanor. It is an elegant technique from a more civilized time. The bad news is that you, I, and the vast majority of people in the world are never going to become as great as the masters who spend their entire lives training. But the good news is that we can get about 90% of the way there right off the bat. The key characteristics of a tempura-style batter are extreme lightness of color and texture. Good tempura should be pale blonde with an extraordinarily lacy, light, and crisp coating. To achieve this takes just a little more care than other types of batter. Traditional tempura batter is made by combining flour, usually a mix of wheat flour and lower protein rice flour. I use wheat flour and cornstarch instead, with eggs and ice-cold water. The batter is mixed until just barely combined, so that plenty of pockets of dry flour remain and virtually no gluten development occurs. A tempura batter has a lifespan of only moments before the flour becomes too saturated with water and a fresh batter must be made. But there are ways we can improve on this fickleness so long as we aren't married to tradition. First off, using the old vodka in the batter trick, which by now you may be sick of, works very well, limiting the rate of gluten formation so that the batter can sit a bit longer before it goes bad. So does replacing the ice water with club soda, a trick I learned from my old chef Ken Oringer at Clio Restaurant in Boston. But the real key is in the process. Rather than simply dumping the dry and wet ingredients into a bowl and whisking them together, I found that by adding the wet ingredients to the dry, then immediately lifting up the bowl and shaking it with one hand, while simultaneously rapidly stirring with a pair of chopsticks, I could get all of the ingredients incorporated while minimizing the amount of flour that is completely moistened by the liquid. French fried potatoes. There's a reason why nearly a third of all potatoes grown in the United States make their way into a fry basket. Fried potatoes are spectacular. No other food achieves quite the same balance of crisp exterior and fluffy interior without the need for any sort of external breading or batter. It all has to do with the natural balances of starches and moisture in the spuds. But making a perfect French fry is not as simple as dunking a potato in hot oil for a few minutes. For the rest of this chapter, we're going to talk about how to achieve crisp, golden nirvana every time. French fries. The intricacies involved in taking two simple ingredients, potatoes and oil, and applying science, heat, and a bit of blind faith, are so complex that it boggles the mind. It took me a good decade to finally decode their secrets to achieve that holy grail of burger joint cookery, the perfect French fry, a substantial, crisp, grease-free crust that cracks open with a puff of steam, revealing a tender, almost fluffy center. There are four basic criteria that define a perfect French fry. Perfect fry factor number one. The exterior must be very crisp, but not tough. In order to achieve such crispness, the surface structure of a fry must be riddled with microbubbles. It's these tiny crisp bubbles that increase the surface area of the fry, making it extra crunchy. Ideally, this layer should only be as thick as it needs to be to add crispness. Any thicker, and you start running into leathery or tough territory. Perfect fry factor number two. The interior must be intact and fluffy and have a strong potato flavor. Fries with a pasty, mealy, or gummy interior, or, even worse, the dreaded state known as hollow fry, when the interior is missing entirely, are an automatic fail. Perfect fry factor number three. The fry must be an even, light, golden blonde. Fries that are too dark or are spotty have an off-putting burnt flavor. Light golden but perfectly crisp is how I want my fries to be. Perfect fry factor number four. The fry must stay crisp and tasty for at least as long as it takes you to eat a full serving. Fries that come straight out of the fryer are almost always perfectly crisp. The true test of a great fry is whether or not it is still crisp and edible a few minutes later, after it's been sitting on your plate. First, a few decisions. For potato variety, russet is what you want. Its high starch content means that it'll fry up crisper than waxier varieties like Yukon Gold or Redskins. It'll also maintain a fluffier interior once cooked. For size, 1/4 to 3/8 inch thick is good, optimizing the ratio of crisp crust while maintaining enough soft center to provide good potato flavor. On to the cooking. Classic French technique will have you believe that the road to perfect fries involves frying once at a relatively low temperature between 275 degrees and 325 degrees Fahrenheit, followed by a resting period, and then a second fry at a higher temperature, between 350 degrees and 400 degrees Fahrenheit. The most common explanation I've heard for this is that the first low-temperature fry allows the fries to soften through to the center, while the second fry crisps up their exterior. I decided to put this theory to the test by cooking three identical batches of fries. The first I cooked per the French technique, a two-stage fry, the first at 275 degrees Fahrenheit and the second at 375 degrees Fahrenheit. For the second, I replaced the low-temperature fry with a trip to a pot of boiling water, then followed up by frying at 375 degrees Fahrenheit as usual. For the third, I skipped the primary step altogether, simply dropping the potatoes into 375 degrees Fahrenheit oil. If the only purpose of the first fry were to cook the potatoes through to the center, then potatoes par-cooked via another method should work just as well. Conversely, a potato that is not par-cooked should not be evenly cooked to the center. The results? The boiled, then fried potatoes were crisp, but the layer of crispness was paper-thin and quickly softened. The single-fry potatoes were quite similar, though slightly less fluffy inside. Still, they were cooked through, no problem. The double-fried fries had a substantial, thick crust that stayed crisp for a while, proving that there's something more going on during that initial fry than simple softening. Indeed, using the set of calipers that my mother had so thoughtfully given me several years ago to try and draw me out of restaurant kitchens and into a much more sensible career, like mechanical engineering or gunsmithing, I was able to determine that the crisp layer on a double-fried fry was more than twice as thick as the one on a boiled, then fried fry, though still not quite as thick as I would have liked it to be. To crack the case, I had to take a closer look at what I was dealing with, starting with putting a potato under a microscope. The anatomy of a potato. Like all plants and animals, potatoes are composed of cells. The cells are held together by pectin, a form of sugar that acts as a glue. Within the cells are starch molecules, large sponge-like molecules composed of many simple sugars bundled together. Starch molecules, in turn, stick together in starch granules. When starch granules are exposed to water and heat, they begin to swell, eventually bursting and releasing a shower of swollen starch molecules. This water can come from the outside, in the case of a boiled potato, or from inside the potato itself, in the case of a double-fried potato, and that bursting of starch granules is essential to forming a thick crust. It's the sticky, gelatinized starches that form the framework for the bubbly crust. So the path to perfect fries seems easy. Just burst a ton of starch granules and you're home free, right? Not that simple. If your potato contains too many simple sugars, it'll brown long before it crisps. Starches and simple sugars will naturally convert their forms back and forth, depending on storage conditions. You can see this effect most dramatically with spring vegetables like peas and asparagus, which come off the vine packed with sugar, but become noticeably less sweet and more starchy even 24 hours after they've been picked. If potatoes have too much sugar, they won't crisp properly, and they'll become an unattractive dark brown as the sugars over-caramelize in the fryer, developing acrid, bitter flavors. The effect is even more dramatic if you try it with potato chips. Unsoaked, unblanched chips end up dark, dark brown, while blanched chips come out nearly transparent. The other difficulty in bursting starch granules is that if the pectin glue holding the cells together has broken down too much before the starch granules have had a chance to burst and release their sticky innards, they will fall apart and crumble before they get a chance to crisp. It's the breakdown of pectin that in some cases, nearly too horrible to mention, causes the dreaded condition known as hollow fry. There are a lot of things that the McDonald's Corporation does wrong, but also some it does right. French fries are one of them. Through millions of dollars worth of research and a partnership with the J.R. Simplot Company, the inventor of the modern frozen French fry, they long ago discovered the key to both washing away excess simple sugars and ensuring that the pectin doesn't break down during frying. Par cook the potatoes in 170 degree Fahrenheit water for precisely 15 minutes. This accomplishes two things. First, it washes away excess simple sugars. Second, and more important, it strengthens the pectin with the aid of a natural enzyme called pectin methylesterase, PME. According to an article in the Journal of Agricultural and Food Chemistry, PME induces calcium and magnesium to act as a sort of buttress for the pectin. They strengthen the pectin's hold on the potato cell's walls, which helps the potatoes stay firmer and more intact even as their starch granules swell and burst. Like most enzymes, PME is only active within a certain temperature range, acting faster and faster as the temperature gets higher and higher until, like a switch, it shuts off completely once it reaches a certain level. Think of PME as little factory workers hard at work building cars. As their floor manager, if you apply a bit of pressure to them, in the form of heat, at first that will get them to work faster. Cars will come off the production line at a faster clip. But apply too much pressure by overheating, and the little enzymes just won't be able to take it anymore, throwing down their tools and walking out. Production slows to a halt. For PME, that shutoff point is just slightly above 170 degrees Fahrenheit. Unfortunately, most home cooks don't have an easy way to maintain a water bath at exactly 170 degrees Fahrenheit for the requisite 15 minutes. I needed to find an alternate way to maintain the pectin structure of the potato while still releasing the starch molecules. And it struck me. It's as easy as apple pie. What's apple pie got to do with French fries? Well, anyone who's ever baked an apple pie knows that different apples cook differently. Some retain their shape, others turn to mush. The difference largely has to do with their acidity. Thus, super tart apples like Granny Smith will stay fully intact, while sweeter apples like Macoun will almost completely dissolve. Just like in a potato, apple cells are held together by pectin, and, as it turns out, acidic environments can reduce or even prevent the breakdown of pectin. So what if rather than trying to fiddle with temperature, I relied on the use of acid to help the potatoes keep their structure? I brought two pots of cut potatoes to a boil side by side, the first in plain water and the second in water spiked with vinegar at a ratio of 1 tablespoon per quart. While the plain water cooked fries had broken down by the time they were cooked through, the fries cooked in the vinegar spiked water stayed perfectly intact, even after boiling them for 50% longer than the other fries. Despite their smooth-looking exteriors, I knew that by boiling them for so long, I'd burst plenty of starch granules. With the excess sugars washed away and the pectin strengthened and ready to buttress the thick, crisp walls my fries would develop in the deep fryer, all that remained was to give them a first fry at 325 degrees Fahrenheit to burst any remaining starch granules and begin crust formation, followed by a second fry at 375 degrees Fahrenheit to bring them up to a perfectly crisp golden blonde. Frying them up proved it. They came out positively riddled with tiny, crisp microbubbles. Moreover, they were crisp enough that they stayed crisp for a full 10 minutes after frying. Why freeze French fries? The best way to preserve fries is to freeze them after the first frying stage. You can then fry them the second time straight from the freezer. But do they lose quality? To test this, I tried freezing half a batch of fries and letting them sit in the freezer overnight before frying them up and tasting them against their unfrozen counterparts. The results were surprising. The frozen fries were actually better, with a distinctly fluffier interior. Why? Freezing potatoes causes their moisture to convert to ice, forming sharp, jagged crystals. These crystals damage the cell structure of the potatoes, making it easier for water to be released and convert to steam when they are heated. And this results in a drier, fluffier interior. The best part? Because freezing actually improved them, I could do the initial blanching and frying steps in large batches, freeze them, and have a constant supply of ready-to-fry potatoes in my freezer, just like Ronald himself. Joël Robuchon's slow-cooked French fries. If you're a member of the online community, and who isn't these days, you've probably read about French chef Joël Robuchon's magic French fry recipe. The idea is simple. Rather than double frying French fries, once cool, once hot, just do the whole process in a single go by putting the potatoes in cold oil, putting the pot on a burner, and letting it go. The potatoes slowly cook through from the outside and, over the course of an hour or so, end up golden brown and crisp. The problem, however, is that with regular fries, the gelatinized starch has a chance to recrystallize in between frying sessions, allowing the fries to become much more structurally sound and crisp. The Robuchon recipe, easy as it is, doesn't produce fries that are anywhere near as crisp as blanched, then double-fried potatoes. Like all things in life, it's a trade-off. Robuchon's method gets a 2 in effort and an 8 in flavor, while the blanched double-fry method is more like a 7 in effort and a 9.5 in flavor. Truth be told, I often opt for the lazy approach. To do it, cut your potatoes and rinse them in water, then carefully dry. Put them in your wok or Dutch oven and cover with oil by an inch or two. Cook the fries over medium heat until they are very soft, about 35 minutes, stirring once or twice in the first 5 to 10 minutes. Increase the heat to high and let them continue to cook for 5 minutes undisturbed, then give them a few gentle stirs and keep cooking until golden brown and crisp, about 10 minutes longer. Drain on a paper towel-lined plate and immediately season with salt. This concludes The Food Lab by J. Kenji Lopez-Alt, narrated by Mike Chamberlain. Copyright 2015 by J. Kenji Lopez-Alt. This unabridged audiobook is published by arrangement with W.W. Norton & Company, Incorporated, and was produced in the year 2019 by Tantor Media, Incorporated, a division of Recorded Books, which holds the copyright thereto. Please visit Tantor.com for more information on our growing library of unabridged audiobooks.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.